I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Scott Ellis. Welcome, Scott.
Hello there.
Well, thanks for joining us. I'll briefly introduce you to our Shipping News audience. Scott Ellis is a member of Patriotic Millionaires, a group of wealthy Americans advocating for higher taxes on the rich, stronger democracy, and fairer economic systems. Who could argue with that? Let me just tell you briefly, listeners, a little more about Scott. He was previously a management consultant at McKinsey and Company and also ran a supply chain analytics organization at Hewlett-Packard. And over the last decade and a half and a bit more, he has founded and led several education nonprofit organizations, served on multiple nonprofit boards, and conducted his family's philanthropic grant making. He has also provided consulting in strategy, operations, and finance to dozens of non-profit CEOs. Scott, you're still a young man. How have you found time to do all of this?
I'm not as young as I look, let's say it that way.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Patriotic Millionaires? How did they come about, and who are the sorts of people who are involved in it, and what's your mission?
I think the real mission is to argue for a better and fairer world for all of us. Sometimes we say we want people to be rich. We want them to be successful, but we want it to be fairer for everyone. And so we want to live in a better and fairer world. The founder, Erica Payne, started it about a dozen years ago. And it was in response to events in the United States as we were looking at how do we get to a better and fairer economy, concerns about the accumulation of wealth on the top end, and concerns that folks on the lower end were not getting a fair opportunity. And I think the power of the members, and Patriotic Millionaires is a membership organization, but the members as unusual messengers. As we say, it's not often that you hear wealthy people saying, I would like you to raise my taxes, please. But that's what we're saying because we say the system is unfair. And we think it's important for us to make sure everyone has an opportunity. We want everyone to be successful. And it starts with a fairer tax code. And so I think that's a big part of the message is how do we create a fair system? How do we raise taxes on the wealthy? And then how do we also improve outcomes for those on the lower end of the wealth spectrum and spread the power for the benefit of all of us?
It to me at least sounds like an irresistible set of propositions, Scott. Do you get pushback from your friends and colleagues, say in the tech industry that you're in?
I don't know if I get as much pushback. I mean, I think a lot of folks haven't heard about it. And so I think there's a part of helping people become more aware. Silicon Valley is a long way from DC. And so I think there's not as much attention paid to some of these issues sometimes. And I think it's changing somewhat now because more people are starting to pay attention. They're starting to pay attention to how are things going in our political system? How are things going in our economy? I think there are more people kind of getting a nagging feeling that maybe things aren't fair and maybe there is a bit too much inequality. And then I think in those moments, people have gone from sort of humoring me and kind of listening to me to saying, oh, wait, now what was that again? And how does this organization work? And so I think people are paying attention more than they used to. And as you say, it may seem like a very reasonable set of propositions, but that's not the direction the United States has gone the last few decades. And so I think we're trying to change that.
Scott, in Australia, I was born and bred here. I've been in some other places over time, but we've always been sold or told about this notion of an American dream, that anybody can become qualified to become a member of Patriotic Millionaires, if you like. But that's not exactly the true lay of the land, is it, in the US? I mean, what is the broader picture that you'd like to see more equitable?
I mean, I think, when I was born, back in the a few decades ago, or maybe more than a few decades ago, I think there was more of a notion that it didn't matter how wealthy you were when you were born or what family you were born into. More folks had an opportunity. Of course, in the United States, we've had systemic discrimination, and so there were certainly parts of the population that really didn't have access. And I think we've made some progress there, but also more broadly speaking, that there was more of a chance where people could pursue a better life for themselves. If they worked hard, got a good education, you could reasonably be expected to buy a nice house, provide for your family. And I think as the years have passed, more and more We see that the key driver of someone's economic outcome is the wealth of their parents and what they were born into. And I think, again, back to the mission of the patriotic millionaires, is how do we establish a world where the American dream is not just a story that deserves to be true, but is a story that is true? I think the data has shown that in recent decades, it's not true, and we want to move back in a direction where it is.
Scott, I think you'd be one of the first people to acknowledge that you've, in a sense, had a dream run. You're privileged. I'd say the same thing about myself, growing up in a time in Australia where everything seemed to be good and everyone had an opportunity. Whereabouts did you grow up?
So I grew up an hour north of Denver, Colorado, so in a town called Fort Collins. It's a university town, maybe 125,000 people or so.
Well, I can remember well calling into Denver, Colorado many years ago in the very late 70s. Well, you obviously did well at school. You went to Harvard, you went then to Stanford Business School. You were on track to do all the things in a sense that you did, finishing up with McKinsey, finishing up with Hewlett-Packard. But I have a sense that something happened along the way that perhaps made you think not just about being a millionaire, but being a patriotic millionaire, as we now understand the definition of that phrase.
Well, I mean, I think I was very influenced by my best friend and college roommate who was from Canada and sort of helped broaden my horizons to think about wealth and inequality and society more broadly. I actually wrote my thesis in college about changes in concentrated poverty in Boston. And so I was really studying the evolution of cities. I worked for a professor who looked at urban America and how cities evolved and how poverty evolved in those cities. And so I was learning about housing and transportation and education and so forth. And then after I graduated, as you said, I worked in consulting, went to business school, worked at Hewlett-Packard, met my wife in business school and kind of started raising a family. But I never forgot about my thesis and the things I learned about there and the idea of trying to fight for a better world. And then I was also very influenced by my parents. And I think, you know, my parents got divorced when I was relatively young, but I give them great credit because they, and then particularly my stepfather, who entered the picture relatively early, they always put my brother and me first. And so they really focused on helping to make sure we had a good opportunity. And I kind of never thought about the importance of the stable family structure. And so in my career, I'd been working at HP for 7 or 8 years, and my wife was a VP at Yahoo. We had two small kids. I was traveling internationally quite a bit, and this all wasn't adding up. And I'm very supportive of women, people of color. My wife and I talked about it and decided that she would really keep pushing forward with her career, but I wanted to make sure that we had really strong parental support for our kids. And so at that point, I really stepped off the corporate path I was on. I decided I didn't want to be the CEO of HP one day. I wanted to think back about making the world a better place and also to be a really strong father for my kids and a supportive husband for my wife. And so in 2007, I left HP and explored what that might look like.
What did that look like? I'm fascinated by everything you've told me so far and how people get to think the way they think, where their values come from. You've answered that in many ways, and your wife plainly shares a lot of that journey with you and that outlook with you. Where do values come from? I don't know. It's a philosophical thing. We could go off to ancient Greece. We could sit around in Athens and try and work it out, I suppose. But what's your take on where your fellow patriotic millionaires have drawn their values from?
I mean, I think it is a combination of either how they're brought up and their families, some educational experiences along the way. So, like, I had some very striking experiences there. People that we meet along the way. Sometimes I see people who are very influenced by bad things that have happened to them or to their parents and that they've observed. And then I think the other is as people have success, pausing to look around. And I think there are times where we really do get caught up in the craziness of life and taking care of ourselves and making money and careers and families, et cetera, but also pausing and saying, are other people having these opportunities too? And I think a lot of the patriotic millionaires that I've talked to really are drawn by a sense both of how do we think about a bigger society and a fair society, and then frankly, a sense of patriotism, which is, you know, I do believe America is special. I believe America means something. I want it to mean something. And so I think when we talk about the organization Patriotic Millionaires, there's a very strong patriotic part of it, which is shouldn't being patriotic mean looking for a better country and a better world for all of us? And then how do we play a role in making that happen?
Well, you've written a couple of really interesting papers. You had an op-ed in Time magazine. You're not a foreigner when it comes to media outlets, and I'm pleased you found it all the way to Fremantle, Australia. Tell me about the thinking behind the paper you wrote, "Pathway to Shared Prosperity." Give us a précis, if you like, a thumbnail picture for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I think in the United States, especially over the last couple of decades, we've really gotten good at arguing with people about what we're against. And so we've gotten very good at opposing people in red state, blue state, and so forth. And I think it's really important for us to stop for a second and say, wait a minute, what are we for? And it's now 2025. I mean, we're not living in the 1100s or even the 1800s or even the 1950s anymore. We're living in the future, at least as I always thought it was. What would we want that to be like? And when we think about what are we for, the vision I have is what we really should be thinking about is shared prosperity. So how do we create a society where we all benefit from the incredible productivity that's been unleashed by technology and progress? And by the way, we've learned a lot about capitalism and about government in the last decades and centuries. We know a lot how to make this work if we pursue a society where we all thrive, meaning that we all have freedom, health, enough wealth, well-being, education, opportunity, and safety. And I think that's a list of things that are actually not that controversial. And if we said, let's set the goal to be that we have that for all of us in our society, how might we do that? How might we reduce the cost of a good life and make it available to everybody? And I think we need some kind of vision like shared prosperity to say, this is what we're for. Now let's stop focusing on what we're against and pursuing what folks call the outrage industrial complex, and instead work together to build a better life for all of us because we're in 2025. Let's go.
And you add into that this concern about excessive wealth. I mean, what sort of wealth are we talking about that is excessive? I mean, we see huge executive pay packages these days. Elon Musk, I've forgotten how many trillions have been approved for him to save the Tesla share price. But what is it about? What does it look like, excessive wealth?
Well, I think one of my main goals is to reframe how we all think and talk about wealth. I think we've kind of been talking about it wrong, or we have just kind of assumed it or not thought about it. I think the starting point is to say, let's define financial success. Right? What does that mean? We're all running around in this economy. My kids are just getting their careers started, and we haven't defined what the goal is. So let's get specific. If you're, roughly 50 years old or so, we say, first goal is you never have to work again. Congratulations, you won capitalism. Here's your trophy, never have to work again. Well, what do you have? You probably have a really nice first house. You might have a nice second house. Your kids' college is all paid for. Your end-of-life health expenses are covered. And you've got a very luxurious life. You've got cars and vacations. I'm a guitar player. I've got nice guitars. Great. Well, again, at about my stage of life, if you do the cash flow forecast with reasonable expectations for investment returns and inflation, with $30 million, you get all that.
30
Right.
mil.
And for $30 million, if you just do the math, right? And so in the United States, and let's use millions of dollars as the currency, so we're talking consistent figures, median household wealth is 0.19, $190,000. So half of households have less than 0.19. So I'm proposing that 30 million, which is over 150 times that, would be a very robust definition of financial success. And so I would like to propose for our society that we say that's enough. And then beyond that, I think we say wealth, it actually turns into power because you get to a point where you really can't make your own life that much better anymore. And so you get wealth that you can use to undermine and influence and distort the political system, the capitalist system, and society overall. And so my proposal is that we should implement an annual 50% wealth tax on wealth over 30 million. So, like we said in Patriotic Millionaires, we want people to be wealthy and successful. Let's define enough, and then let's be careful about managing power beyond that.
It's fascinating. I mean, you could probably index that sum over time to keep the 30 mil in mind, and you tax it with 50% on household wealth exceeding that, and presumably that money goes in like US tariff revenue is meant to, back into consolidated revenue, and you spend it on good things, Scott. But But what's the danger that comes with excessive wealth?
Well, I mean, the main thing I think about again is the accumulation and concentration of power in a small number of hands. And so fundamentally, I'm worrying about whether wealthy individuals are able to distort markets, to undermine capitalism, and to control the media, which are some of the pillars of our societies. And so we see excessively wealthy individuals buying major media outlets, controlling what those outlets say, and managing that. We see people providing millions or hundreds of millions of dollars for political campaigns to get people elected. And my view would be that we absolutely each should have the right to say what we think. We each have the right to vote. We should all be able to spend a few thousand dollars to support a political candidate. But once someone is able to spend tens or hundreds of millions of dollars on elections, I worry that that citizen has a lot more influence than I do as a citizen. And so the main thing I'm worried about as a citizen is how much power do other citizens have? And I think we all should be thinking about and asking that question.
Scott, there are two things that I think many Australians, certainly I, have always pondered about when it comes to the US, particularly in recent times, is the famous PACs, the political financing organisations that can raise millions, probably, millions isn't the right expression, and it can be spent in the way it's spent. And of course, the other thing is guns. We won't talk about guns today, but it would probably be part of the general discussion, I suppose, about a new America. But are the principles you're talking about shared across, yes, the red-blue divide? Are the people who are involved in your organization people who, in that sense, cross the aisle?
I mean, I think to a certain extent, I mean, I think the most important thing in my view is for us to have the conversation. I mean, wealth is something that all of us have. It affects all of us. And frankly, we're not talking about it. And I don't think we're talking about it right. And what we haven't done is, as a society, define how much is enough and how much is too much. And so I think that's something that applies for both folks on the red side or the blue side or the wealthy or the less wealthy. Frankly, the group that I think needs to talk about it the most are the 95 plus percent who don't have excessive wealth and probably never will, to say, wait a minute, do we want to vote for a better and fairer society? Because we have that power, we need to recognize it, and then we need to step up and do it.
There seem to be some funny things going on in the US at the minute. The New York City's got a new mayor in waiting, Scott, mayor-to-be Mamdani, who seems to be, well, I think President Trump called him a communist, but I think he's self-described as a democratic socialist. Is that some sort of thing that's happening in the US, or is it just a one-off? Is there some concern about how the ordinary people are not thriving in the US?
I mean, I think there's been a concern for many years. I think now it's being drawn into much sharper relief. And I think people are paying much more attention. And again, paying attention to things like the pay package for Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos's wedding in Venice, and then seeing more how people with that level of wealth are using it to do things like buy Twitter and buy the Washington Post and the implications that that has. So I think people are seeing that. Frankly, myself, I would say that I've been fortunate and able to travel internationally quite a bit in the last few years. And guess what? I'm going to lots of places all around the world that are doing wonderfully and are safe and clean with wonderful education and healthcare, et cetera. And sometimes I feel like the United States is a little stuck in like 1995. And it's a really good 1995, but a lot of other countries are figuring things out. And so I do think that we're paying more attention as a society. And I think eventually it does show up in election results. And I think the last piece I would add is for people under 40 in this country, it is very difficult to buy a house. And so people are struggling to get married, to launch their careers, to launch their lives in the ways that they might have in the 1970s and 80s. And so I think there are real concerns about whether our society is providing the kind of economic opportunity for all that we want. And I think it does show up in elections.
Well, you're certainly talking to an Australian audience. It's the same housing problem in this country. Trying to supply housing is a huge challenge, and it seemed to everything ever since COVID. Supply chains, things that you know about from your olden days, are really in play. But tell me this: as I read the 30 million dollar project, the 50% tax, is on household wealth. You'd
Correct.
lodge your annual return, you'd show what you've got, someone would make the assessments and verify it. But what about the Gates Foundation? What about all of the lawyers out there who'll be immediately working on tax avoidance plans for their wealthy clients once you enact your tax?
Well, I mean, I think we should be clear that those folks, and often we call them the wealth defense industry, are already very active. And so if people think that that's not happening already, I would say it's already happening. And I think the other thing I would say is the reason why I'm advocating a law, and again, it's a law, which is a thing that is very simple and straightforward that governments already do. So it's a simple law, but the reason I'm advocating it is because voluntary solutions won't work. If voluntary solutions would work, we wouldn't have the problem in the first place. People would accumulate $50, $100 million, and then would say, I've got plenty. I'm going to donate the rest. I'm going to share it. I'm going to use it to build a better society. That's not happening. And so I think we do need a change in the tax code. And the reality is, we pass laws all the time, whether we're talking about speed limits or whether you're allowed to take things from the store without paying for them. Guess what? People sometimes break those laws. We have a process for that. The same is true here. And so I don't think we should say, oh, we're not sure we're going to be able to enforce it, so let's just not pursue it in the first place. That's not how society works. That's not how it's ever worked. And I do think we need to be clear-eyed about the implications, but I think we should be very clear-eyed about what's happening today. And that's a lot of what I'm trying to help people to see is how much wealth do people have? What's the impact? And let's decide whether to do something about it.
It really is interesting. I think law, which I've spent a fair amount of my career thinking about, does two things. One, it actually regulates. It would impose, in your case, a 50% wealth tax over $30 million in a household setting. But it also, I guess, it is virtue signaling. It's saying, do we not all share this view about how society should work? And I suppose it to some extent, it censors those whose only ambition in life is to accumulate more and more wealth. It doesn't stop them doing it, of course. They just have to pay the tax.
Well, I would almost turn it differently, which is I want people to be successful. I want them to pursue a better life for themselves and for their friends and their family. I want them to innovate. Fantastic. I believe that some people innovate because they want to build new, cool things. There are some people whose only goal is to accumulate money and power for the sake of exploiting others, but I don't think there are actually very many people like that. I think this is really about all of us together saying excessive wealth is bad for all of us. So we should just manage it. And frankly, as humans, we're kind of wired to accumulate more, right? We're wired to survive. We're wired to survive in times of scarcity. As we move toward a time of abundance, it gets trickier. But I do think the key for all of us is to say, eventually, let's just make it so that's not cool, right? And I think there are lots of examples we can talk about where it's not okay for someone to go to a restaurant. And when you're leaving, not just take one or two mints from the little bowl, but take all the mints from the bowl and all the mints from the back in the storage room so no one else can have it. Like, no, we wouldn't do that. Well, wealth should be the same way. And so, can we get to a place where it's just socially unacceptable to be excessively wealthy? And I'd love to do that rather than have the law. We probably need both.
Coming back to the particular project of patriotic millionaires, I see there's also this great economy project that's underway. Can you tell us about that? This seems to be the very practical side of the mission.
Now, I mean, I think a lot of the goal here is to help people focus on money. And so the thought process is to go to very conservative communities in very conservative districts and to meet with people. And so hosting dinners and educational seminars over a series of weeks. And the goal is to say, we're not going to talk about religion. We're not going to talk about guns. We're not going to talk about abortion. All we're going to talk about is money. Who has it? How do you get it? Where does it come from? To make sure that people understand, so they understand how much wealth they have, how much wealth do average CEOs have, how much wealth do other people have, and then to understand what their elected officials are advocating for. Are their elected officials advocating for higher minimum wages, for lower taxes on people like themselves? Are they advocating for higher taxes to rein in excessive wealth? And then let the people decide what they may want to do about it. But it really is about helping to educate voters. And you laughed a little bit when I said that about just focusing on money, But we really are clarifying, folks, there is an issue about wealth, and we all need to understand it. So I've got my personal lens on it, but the Patriotic Millionaires is really focused on this as well, because we think it's really critical for people to be well educated so they can decide how to vote.
Well, you took off a group, obviously, to Whiteville, North Carolina, back a couple of years ago, and the blurb that I read with that, 60 people from different backgrounds and a wide range of political beliefs, Republicans, Independents, Democrats, and hate 'em all types, got together. So, how did that develop? How did it prosper?
Well, I mean, I think it starts by identifying some communities that might be potential locations that would be interested in this kind of program, building relationships with people in the communities, and then starting ha to have a series of events. And like many things that I've seen in my career, starting with kind of a prototype to say, let's start small, let's start some conversations, let's see how it goes, let's see how people respond. And what we saw is over time, week after week, people kept coming. And they wanted to know more, and they were asking questions, and it was helpful for them to understand their own lives and understanding them in a way that it frankly hadn't been clarified to them before, because there is a lot of complexity in the media and complexity in markets. And so really stepping forward and cutting through all that and saying, let's talk about what the minimum wage is. Let's talk about how much money CEOs make. Let's talk about what the tax policies are, so educators then get the or so so citizens get the information they need, so they can then vote intelligently in their own interests. And I think what we found is that people appreciated that. And as time comes, you build community in that work. But in our framing, it really starts with pulling people together, not as Democrats, not as Republicans, not as conservative or liberal, but as Americans, to say, what kind of society do we want? And we've got to start talking about wealth as part of that discussion.
I'm guessing, possibly incorrectly, that when you bring the people together in a place like Whiteville, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives are maybe even conversing over these issues for the first time.
Could be, and again, a lot of the communities are pretty conservative. But there's also a re so there certainly is cross-party conversation. But I think a lot of it is people are busy, and a lot of people are struggling. And when people are struggling financially and lives are busy, they're not really going to have time to talk about a lot of these things, like how much wealth do people have. And there might be a sound bite about an executive compensation thing someplace, but it's not going to lead to something that they need to take action on right away. And so there's a part which is just giving people a few minutes to slow down, to clarify what's happening, and then they can decide whether this is something they have have time to address in their busy lives. And since it affects their own financial well-being, oftentimes they decide it does. But there's a lot going on for people, and the key is just to enable people to pause for a second and understand how important this issue is.
That sense of community really resonates with me. Fremantle Shipping News came into being nearly 9 years ago, and we're told that we've created a community in a well-established community. It's interesting. We're described in media terms as a hyper-local media outlet, but people do respond to these sorts of issues. You go back to that statistic you mentioned, $190,000 for, did you say 50% of the American population of
Yeah,
households?
that's the median wealth. So
Median
half
wealth.
have less than that. That's right.
It's a stunning figure because it immediately blows out of the water for so many people. Well, that everybody's living the American dream.
No, I mean, I think the one of the things I struggle with the most is to help people just understand the magnitude of excessive wealth and what we're talking about. So, for example, we throw around terms like, oh, this person has $10 billion. Well, if we pause for a second and say, that's actually $10,000 million. And so median household has 0.19. I'm saying 30 is enough, and that's very successful. And a person over here has 10,000 million. The pay package that they were talking about for Elon Musk is $1 trillion, but it's actually $1 million. And so my question is, really, folks, do we really think that we can't and shouldn't take steps to manage that? And people are very worried that it's going to reduce the incentive for people to work hard. And I would say $30 million and never having to work again is a pretty good incentive. Let's just make sure we understand how much wealth there really is out there, and then say, look, if half of our country has 0.19, 10% of people are living in poverty, are we really not going to take action when someone's got $100,000 million?
Scott, I don't think I'd be putting words into Elon Musk's mouth, But I'm sure he would say something to you like, Scott Ellis, you're just trying to undermine the capitalist system.
I would say I'm trying to save the capitalist system. As I talk to people under 40, I was actually told about an organization recently that had an offsite and they were trying to talk about their vision, and a lot of it was related to saving capitalism. And they had a riot on their hands because the people under 40 said, it's not working for any of us, right? None of us can afford to buy a house, right? We're having trouble finding jobs. AI is coming. I recently was, reading a report that talked about the fact that AI over the next 3 years will impact 49 million jobs in the United States. This is real. And so I'm actually trying to save capitalism. That is my goal. And I think we need to save capitalism from itself. Sometimes I think about capitalism, it's like nuclear energy. It's incredibly powerful. But if you don't put the control rods in, the whole thing melts down and you have a chain reaction on your hands. We have a chain reaction on our hands now. I think we need to make sure we preserve this way of life, and we should preserve it for all of us.
Scott, you mentioned earlier in relation to the Great Economy Project that one of the questions is could be minimum wages. This notion of perhaps universal income, is that something that you could explain further?
Well, the thing I think about is, we should be benefiting from the incredible productivity unleashed by technology, right? Back in the 1930s, John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous economist, was worried that 100 years from now, right, in the year 2030, we would have a leisure crisis because everything would be so productive that no one would need to work very much. And what would we do? Well, we haven't chosen to do it that way, right? We've chosen to build a society where a small number of people get incredibly rich and 10% of people are living in poverty. And with AI coming and the productivity continuing, I think we need to do something, right? We need to make a shift, and we should fundamentally think about what does it mean to be part of our modern society, and what should members of our society get? And now I go back to shared prosperity. We want everyone to have freedom, to have health, to have enough wealth. And I think something like higher minimum wages or universal basic income, these are solutions to distribute the benefits of this incredible productivity, so that they're not just being accumulated by a small number of individuals who are then using it to undermine the system, but instead sharing it so that we all benefit. This is technology productivity that our society has created. Our full society should benefit. And I think we need to be taking specific steps to make that happen.
Scott, can I just come back to you and some of your background? The non-profits that you became involved in from what, around 2007 or so, particularly in education, how did that happen and what sort of enterprises were you engaged in?
Well, when I left Hewlett Packard, I wanted to go help save the world, but I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know anything about nonprofits or foundations or philanthropy. And so what I did, in addition to really providing support for my wife, and we got a helper for me at home so I could work, but I was always the first line of defense on the home front, but was to start doing a lot of volunteer consulting in different areas and different types of organizations to figure out what this might look like. And I finally decided I was interested in alternative energy, education, and healthcare as three areas that I thought would be valuable and I might be able to make a contribution. And of those three, education just spoke to me the most. I believe education, it is the silver bullet. This is how you enable people to pursue a better life, all the good things we talk about. And so I put together an email that I sent out to my network saying, I'm interested in helping organizations in education, and I work on strategy, finance, operations, et cetera. Let me know if you know some organizations that could use my help. My email got passed around. I had breakfast with a gentleman. I told him what I just told you. He said, great, I've got a few education organizations that could use your help. And so I ended up being on the board of one of them and advising the CEO. And then I found this organization called New Teacher Center that does mentoring programs for new teachers. And I just thought it was an amazing organization with really incredible people. And I thought I could add a lot as a business person in this kind of crazy nonprofit education space. And so I helped that organization spin out of the university where it had been incubated to become its own nonprofit. Then I became the chief operating officer and chief strategy officer. So I ended up being there for about 3.5 years. And then when I finally stepped away, I decided I wanted to stay in the social sector. But in order to have the impact I wanted, I really needed to be a CEO if I was going to do it, because it's very difficult sometimes to make a positive difference in the social sector as a business person. It's challenging. And so I ended up really focusing on what I call blended or mastery learning. And so this is really enabling students to move forward at their own pace as they master content, and personalizing learning so kids can learn in different ways. And so since 2012, I've started a few different organizations that are all really linked to this issue of how do we enable kids to learn at their own pace and in ways that really work for them. And so that's been the main part of my journey. And then the last part is doing a lot of volunteer consulting for other nonprofit leaders, because as time has passed, I do now have a nearly 20-year track record. And so I've got a lot of scars from trying to help that I can then use as wisdom to help others.
I think I mentioned earlier you're currently founder and CEO of Mastery Track. That brings all together, does it, the educational learnings that you've had.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it also connects with my work at Hewlett-Packard. So much of what I did at HP and supply chain was about data visualization to support executive decision making. How do you make sure the executives get the information they need at the right time in the right way to decide what to do? Mastery Track is the same thing. How do we enable educators and students to see where students are in their learning so you can figure out what to do next? And so I think it really does tie together my education work, but also my consulting and analytical work to focus on, trying to solve a specific problem that I think I have something to bring that could be helpful for both, students and teachers.
Scott, we're coming towards the end of our podcast, but there's two questions I have to ask you. I note that personally you're an avid sports fan. You're a kung fu black belt, which impresses me because it frightens me. But you wrote a novel. You enjoy guitar, piano, drums, musical, poker as well. Not sure about your poker face, but you then say diplomacy with a capital D is one of your personal pursuits. First, tell me about the novel and what happened to it, and tell me finally about diplomacy with a big D.
Oh, well, yeah. So I wrote a novel in 2012, and it's kind of a political thriller, or at least that's the intention. It's actually called USA 2020, The Ultimate Crisis. So it's a little bit interesting to see how things have played out. But the basic idea was, what might it look like if someone came along and saved the US and took us in a direction that might be very successful? And a lot of it captures my wealth inequality ideas. And so that was my goal. It was really inspired by Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, which I love the novel, but it was sort of the other way, where instead of saying, hey, this is a fierce defense of the wealthy, I'm like, no, what if we said a fierce defense of everyone else, and what would it look like? And so it was a very challenging process, but I was grateful to have that opportunity. And then diplomacy. Well, we should do a whole separate podcast on diplomacy, but it's one of my favorite games, and it's basically a war game set in Europe in mid 20th century, and it's all about making alliances with colleagues which you may or may not choose to keep. The thing I love most about it is that I really am genuinely I like to think a kind, honest person trying to do good things in the real world. But in diplomacy, I can be as evil as I want, and it helps me win.
I'm sure it also helps you, though, be a very good patriotic millionaire, Scott Ellis.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for joining me today. It's been fascinating talking to you, and may I wish you and your colleagues on Patriotic Millionaires all the best with their mission. It's fascinating to hear.
Well, thanks so much for having me.